Welcome to the Sunday Jazz Spotlight. I'm your host, Dwayne Benton, and we have the exclusive that I have put on the wall, on the bucket list, all of that. I'm talking this hour to the one and the only Kirk Whalum. Excited out of all, and I love all of these brothers and sisters that I've talked to over the time, but this was the one that I needed to be able to say check mark, done deal, the one, the only international Grammy winning. I could just keep naming all of the titles for this brother, but he's known around these parts as our brother Kirk Whalum. Welcome to the Sunday Jazz Spotlight.
What, man? Listen, the people know who the real star is on this particular you know, interchange, and that would be Mr. Benton. Like, oh. They're like, oh no, you know, these artists, yeah, there's too many of them, but there's only one Dwayne Benton.
Well, listen, there's only one Kirk Whalum. Kirk, you and I go way back into my early radio days in Memphis when I was hosting a show called Gospel Jazz on Sundays on WHAL, Hallelujah. And I remember one time you actually came in and sat in on my show. I just couldn't believe that this was a real moment in my life, and I'll forever be able to tell people Kirk Whalum sat in for me.
That's great. Yeah, so and those are some very big shoes. I have a song called Big Old Shoes. You know, I initially wrote it for Grover Washington, but yeah. That's how I felt that day. Like, Lord Jesus, I don't know what I'm doing.
I was terribly afraid and scared when you finished. I'm like, okay, now they're going to move me out of the way and pull Kirk in. But I'm so glad that you were so busy that you just didn't have time to do a radio show. So.
Oh, is that why they didn't call?
That's what I want to say. Kirk, let's dive into your life and your music. Let's go back. I'm looking at your projects. Now, the first recorded project was called Floppy Disk.
Floppy disk, just like the old, you know, yeah. the first computers.
Yeah, floppy disk was your first project back in 1985. How did that come to be? How did you get to the place of being called a recording artist?
Well, that's great. I mean, first of all, let me say that floppy disk CD being my debut was a little perplexing to one Reverend Kenneth T. Whalum Sr. Because he was like, when he saw the cover, he's like, oh, that's so great, son, congratulations. And I showed him the cover. He kind of the cusp of, you know, computer assisted.
Yeah.
Not computerized, but a computer assisted music. All music today is computer assisted in one way or another, even what we're doing right now, right?
I mean,
we're doing it by way of computer.
Absolutely.
You know, but yeah, so that project was a big deal because I had opened a concert for Bob James in Houston, where I was living, going to Texas Southern, mm-hmm. and my band thrashed, man. And he was like, okay, that's not good. The audience has peaked long before I have even come out on stage, so I can't let that happen. So he, sure enough, I got a call, can you, you know, from his manager, can you come to New York and record with Bob James? He wants you to be, basically, be in his band, you know?
Wow. So
he said, I'm gonna hire this guy. In that way, that'll never happen again, you know, the way he upstages me. So that's how that record came about.
Wow. Thank you. first recording contract, was it exciting? Was it good? Was it bad? Were there lessons learned? You know, because now you've been doing it a while and you can go back and look at that first record deal. How do you describe it?
Well, it was convoluted. You know, on the one hand, it was kind of hard in one sense, right? But in another, there I was with the platform because of Bob Dings to make music on an international level. I was literally, as we're talking, I just got back to Japan, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been there, I think, 20 times. I've been there a lot of times.
Wow.
But the very first time was the year after we're talking about with Floppy Disk, my first record.
Right.
Touring with Bob Dings. I'm, in 1986, I'm in Japan, you know? And I'm 20-something years old. And, you know, it was such a big, it was so hefty, weighty, a big part of my life.
Drown.
were you pretty much guided by the label on how you were going to sound, or you brought your own sound to it?
So at the beginning, fortunately for me, Bob James heard something he wanted to capture and present.
Yeah.
With the great Bob James. And I'm going to have our homeboy, Kirk Whalum, open a concert. So, so that was, you know, that was the connection. You know, that's the thing, like, you do what you do in a small, I mean, that's your story too, Dwayne. Like, you do what you do in a setting that is not, you know, stellar.
Right.
But you're doing your very best. And you look around and you get called up higher. You know, that's, you know, the Bible says promotion comes neither from the east nor the west nor the south. Right. Only God exalts a person to the next level.
Yeah. So let's talk about the family. Not the, and I reference your father per se. You guys coming up brothers in the house together. You started diving into music when?
Well, you know, from the very beginning, man.
Yeah.
You know, I would go, I would sit on my grandmother's lap. Well, because I could really say both. I sat on both my grandmother's laps. You know, like one was a domestic, Lily Mae Marshall, my mother's mom. But she sang gospel, and she, you know, I know I had to have been sitting in her lap at some point with her humming, you know, Precious Lord or something.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting in my other grandmother's lap at the pipe organ, at Metropolitan Baptist, you know, and you know, then just to hear, to go and hear the Morehouse.
A huge life. We're talking to the one and the only Kirk Whalum. He's with us on the Sunday Jazz Spotlight. This is Gospel Jazz Radio.
Thank you.
to the Sunday Jazz Spotlight. My special guest today is renowned saxophonist Mr. Kirk Whalum. Whitney Houston sort of thrust you into the stratosphere. Would you say that?
Yes, in a very big way. Yeah. You know, and it's funny, Dwayne, she used to say, use my name if it'll help. She would tell all of us, you know, in the band. And
okay.
Use my name if it'll help, but it ain't going to always help, you know. And, you know, I thought that was funny when I reflected back on that one time I was here in Memphis playing at an elementary school for career day.
Yeah.
And, you know, and these kids, I'm up there, and the lady made a big deal. Like, she was in my age group. She said, you know, and he played with Whitney Houston. And you could look on those kids' faces, they're like, who's that?
What?
Of course. I mean, think about it. I mean, these kids, you know, we're a couple of generations now away from her heyday.
Right. Gotcha.
So that's just the way it is. You know, you're going to fade away. Now, someday they'll discover her music, right?
Yeah.
And maybe they'll look back and say, oh, wow, I met her saxophone player, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the way it is.
How did that happen? How did you end up as her touring soloist saxophonist?
I was on a jazz gig. I moved to L.A. in 1987. And just the first couple of months there, I said, I got to establish some kind of presence here. So we booked a jazz gig in a small club called Le Café. And I'm like, I need a band. And I had a drummer who I knew from Texas. He said, man, here, hire this guy on bass. He's amazing. So I hired Ricky Minor.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people now know that name from the Grammys, from the Oscars,
yeah,
from, you know, all over. But at the time, he was Whitney, you know, he's the heat right now. He's the musical director of just about everything important, the NAACP Award, you name it. But at that time, he was Whitney Houston's bass player.
Yeah.
And, you know, but he was, you know, he was off work, you know, it wasn't touring, and so he played this gig. And I get a call the next day. He's like, man, I was kind of auditioning you. I'm going to go ahead and admit it. Because I'm looking for a sax player. I just got promoted. I'm Whitney's musical director.
Oh, wow.
How would you feel about going on the road with Whitney Houston? I just dropped the phone. It would have been, I knew, Dwayne, one thing I knew that it meant was that it would be the very first time Ruby and I would know where our money was coming from, like months down the line.
Wow.
But above all this, I wish you
So when Wikipedia says the single I Will Always Love You was the best-selling single by a female artist in music history, how do you feel about that?
Right. So, you know, I have read that, right? And then what it translates into, if you think about it, is that the saxophone solo that I played has been heard by more people than any other saxophone solo ever recorded. Now, Dwayne,
yeah,
think about that. Think about John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Cannonball Adderley, Charlie Parker. Just think of the heroes,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
My avatar, you know, Memphis own Charles Lloyd. I mean, just think about all the amazing saxophone players.
Yeah.
You can't say that, but I can, because Whitney insisted on having us play live with her. There was, people don't realize, I think they assume she, you know, lip sync, but she's singing live to the film and we are playing. You can't see us because they had to cordon off, you know, they had to put a thick curtain between us and her, because mm-hmm. you had to try to separate the voice from all the instruments. But we're there playing while she's singing.
I didn't know this. This is the first I've ever heard that. When she
yes,
performed that song in the movie,
yes.
You guys were back there.
We were back there. We all played at the same time. I think we did 3 takes of it. But I'm 98% sure that the one that you hear is the first one, because, again, it's like the spirit of the living God is inhabits this song in such a way where it carries it all. The spirit carries it all over the world.
Yeah. I talked to your brother a few weeks ago. We had a great conversation, and he said to me that when your, I guess, career as far as a recording artist with a major label came to an end, you decided to go in a different direction. Why did you do that? And I'm talking about the Gospel According to Jazz.
Right. So it was a very big thing that happened to me. First of all, let's say that the groundwork had been laid, right?
Right.
For me to do something, you know, gospel and jazz and blending all those things. But the groundwork was something awful that happened. That was me getting dropped from Columbia Records.
Oh.
And, you know, again, the label that I was signed to because of Bob James. And that big career, meteorite that just, you know, blew up on my career.
Right.
Was devastating. And, you know, here I am thinking, wow, I really thought I was at the pinnacle, you know, being on Columbia.
Right.
And that I did a TED talk on this. People can find my TED talk on TEDx talk. But, you know, on YouTube, my wife said to me in this moment, and again, this is why you try to marry a godly mate.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay, what can you do today that you couldn't do yesterday when you were a Columbia recording artist? And it just stopped my train, and I was about to go into full, you know, pity party mode.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly what I would do. Even though I was moping around, so I didn't really let on to her. But
yeah,
I knew what I would do. Because George Duke and Michelle Farrell and Jonathan Butler and I have been touring. And we just one day on the tour, you know, maybe after George played, after he played that, Jonathan went into My Precious Lord, just him and the guitar.
Hmm.
And then all of a sudden we all joined in, because of course we all know the song. And bro, there was a thunderous round, like standing ovation for that song.
Yeah.
And I went, now wait a minute. It was like, I'm just calculating it, trying to, in my brain, like, these people are out here to have a good time, you know, have some drinks and do their thing. And here we play Precious Lord, and they are stunned, you know.
Everybody loves the gospel.
You know, that's the thing. Well, I guess you could say not everybody does, but the gospel finds its way into people's hearts when it rides on the back of music.
Right.
Like, people can't resist it. It's like, I would say an instrumental musician in particular, but gospel can break and enter into a person's heart if you can sit them down long enough.
Right.
You know, you have no defenses against it. And so that's what happened. And I knew when she asked me a question, I said, well, I would just do that. I would do a record featuring musicians who are not quote unquote gospel musicians.
Mm-hmm.
But we would go there, you know, volitionally. We would say, let me be clear. Here's George Duke, who is not a Christian technically.
Okay.
Right? And later on, you know, there are others like Layla Hathaway, I'm not a Christian, or I always say yet, but I can say qualitatively that there's someone greater, and that this music is profoundly spiritual and powerful, you know. So that was the platform, not to go make a gospel record, because there's so many great gospel acts. I wasn't trying to do that.
Right.
No, we were trying to fit in another slot.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm Kirk Whalen. Mike Manson on bass, J.D. Blair on drums, my special guest, Paul Jackson Jr. on guitar, George Duke on piano. Ladies and gentlemen, the Gospel According to Jazz.
there's ever been, per se, especially alive. When you talk about gospel according to jazz, I've never heard anyone take on something like that and just make it the way you did it. I'm sorry, I can't compare it.
Yeah, man, my brother Kenneth, Reverend KT Jr., he says, go ahead and accept it, man. You invented, initiated, you know, whatever, a whole genre of music. I'm like, no, man, I did. You know,
yes,
we had a garden.
Yes,
and,
sir.
You know, I always refer him to Koinonia. There's an LA studio band called Koinonia, Koinonia.
Mm-hmm.
And that word means fellowship. But they were all studio musicians, Abraham Laborio, Hadley Hockensmith, Harlan Rogers, et cetera, Huso Amadio. They were out there in LA playing sessions for everybody, man. You just name an artist, Al Jarreau, just on and on. But they were professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly jazz musicians, but, you know, who also play pop or whatever. But they did these projects. You can look them up, Koinonia. And they became my avatar. You know,
yeah.
I'm like, I want to do that. I want to play for God, but not necessarily in the gospel genre per se, but out here in the greater world, but to represent God out there and say, I am trying to be excellent on this instrument. This is my pursuit. And I want that to be my sacrifice to God. Not, you know, just, oh, I play gospel and everybody's supposed to just get with me because I love Jesus.
Yeah.
I want it to be people hear this music and go, wow.
You know, they say that King David danced before the Lord with all his might. And I really thank God for this next song because it really expresses that same mood of worshiping God without holding back. And I'd like to play it for you now. It's called All My Might. Thank you.
You're listening to the Sunday Jazz Spotlight with my special guest, Kirk Whalum. All right, this is a special show for me, and why it's so special is because we're going into the second hour. That's right, it's another hour with Kirk's music and his conversation. You don't want to miss it. Limited commercial interruption. So let's take a break now, and when we come back on the other side of the break, we continue the Sunday Jazz Spotlight with Kirk Whalum.